cordially welcome you to my podcast, Neue Musik Leben. I have studied classical singing, but I'm singing lots of contemporary and experimental music, and I do performance. If you would like to know more about me and all about my concerts and anything I'm doing, please look at my website www.irenekurke.de. It is also possible to subscribe to my monthly newsletter. You will find the button on my starting page, on my homepage, and you will find out everything about me, what I'm doing singing-wise or with this podcast or with my books or with my radio. As some of you know, I have this format. It's called Chaos Radio Summit. It's a radio station that is based in California. And I do a show every fourth Saturday in a month. And I called it Live Your Music and Live Your Life. And I'm presenting great music there for you. And after the live streaming on this Saturday, in the fourth Saturday in a month, it will also be presented in a podcast format that you can also listen to it if, you know, you cannot make it. Or, I mean, some of my listeners live in a different time zone and whatever, they're already sleeping. And yeah, so you could also follow me there. But all these informations, are in my newsletter. In this podcast, I talk with you about themes all around this thing we call new music, experimental contemporary music, and I share with you the behind the scenes, the insider knowledge, and what is most important to me. I really want to bring you the human beings out of this world closer to you. And I thank you so much that you're tuning in, that you're following me, that some of you are writing me where you are. What this podcast does with you, or sometimes you also give me great inspirations or ideas for future episodes. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, which is one of the most important German music papers we have here. And today I have a wonderful guest for you. It's the composer and pianist and blogger and Moritz Eggert. And this is very special to me in many ways. One of it is that I think we really know each other about 20 years now, maybe even a little longer. That is a time to really know a person, to see them also grow and develop. I mean, I see him, he sees me. To collaborate for this long time over and over again. I have recorded many of his songs on a CD. You can still get or find it on Spotify. And it's always a pleasure because he is kind, he's appreciating, he's very professional, and I think he composes great music and very unique music. I really think he totally has his own style, and maybe you've already figured that out about me, that I like people who really have their own style and do their own thing and don't care what's going on or if there are any trends or whatever. And so, and he also has been a guest. I think he has been the guest who has been most often in my podcast, but all the other episodes have been in German so far. But Moritz told me you could now with AI somehow make it work for you if you want to listen to it, because there's so many touching points all the time that I feel like, oh, I really need to talk to Moritz again. Let's talk about this. And now I have the honor to have our first English interview for you, because I think you also are curious to get to know this person, this wonderful human being and composer. So let's dive into the interview with Moritz Eggert. Hello and good morning, Moritz Eggert in Munich. I welcome you to into my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Hello, Irene.
And you're a composer, pianist, blogger, conductor. You're also very active. What is, how would I call it? Like music lobbyism, for Germany, royalties and all of that. But we're going to talk about it. And I'm really excited because you have been a guest on my podcast quite often, but so far we talked in German because the podcast is also in German. But yeah, I'm doing more and more English episodes, and I know there are many listeners out there, and they also would like to know more about you, Moritz.
I've seen, though, so, you know, there's AI now that can actually live translate and also change the look of the face so that the lips are synced. I've seen this in action a couple of times, probably pretty expensive software still, but
wow.
So you can translate all your podcasts in live, in real time. In any language, yeah, probably also Arabic or something.
Okay, that's exciting. So anyone can listen to us, but we're still gonna do it in English.
Yeah, yeah. But English is fine.
We're not gonna talk Arabic now, right?
No.
So at first, I would like to know from you, how did you find your way into this new and experimental music?
Yeah, I was starting out as a pianist relatively late. I had piano lessons from when I was 6 years old, but I was never really studying with the goal of becoming a pianist. And that was a vocation I found pretty late in life. I mean, for classical music, so I was around 15. And I was absolutely voracious to know more music. And I think the first encounter with what we call contemporary music, which of course is now classical music historically, but was Erik Satie and Charles Ives. These were composers that I really enjoyed a lot. And I studied their music as much as I could. And I had a very good piano professor, Leonard Håkansson, at the Frankfurt University of Music. And he was very, you know, supporting me to also learn composers of our time, like Fredrik Reshevsky. I played piano music of his. And so I naturally graduated towards more and more experimental, complex, arty, how you call it, music. And that was a natural progression. There was never a decision or something, but I was just fascinated by different kinds of music. And at that time, I was much more bored with Viennese classic than I am now. Now I really love Haydn and Beethoven and this style of music. But at that time, I found it a bit boring, to be honest. It took me many years to understand what's great about it.
Didn't you also say once that you like played in a band or something?
Yeah, that was the thing. So I was actually, I came to the piano by playing in a school band, and we played kind of prog rock music. So naturally, I also started to compose for them. These were my first compositions for my band members. I composed pieces for electric bass solo for my friend Markus Demel on the electric guitar. So this was an activity I had parallel to my classical studies for a long time. So I was playing in jazz ensembles, in rock ensembles, whatever. Yeah? And at some point I stopped doing that, which was in a way a bit sad because I really liked the people I played with, but I felt I had to concentrate more on learning Chopin etudes and, you know, technique as a classical pianist, because that takes a lot of time. But I did return to these genres later on, so I always profit from this background.
I know, because oftentimes there's a little bit of this in your compositions, I know.
Yes, but also because I actually do still sometimes play this kind of music. So I did a jazz album much later, which was one of the most fun projects I did in my life. I also collaborated with pop bands and stuff like that. So knowing how to play keyboards and to work in that kind of environment is an experience that I've needed from, and which stems from that time. So I'm happy I did that.
And so I've always known you as a person. I mean, later on you added things, but for a long time you were a pianist and a composer. So how did you bring those two things together, or how do you do it during the day? I mean, do you have times where you practice piano? Do you have times where you compose?
Yeah, during studies, it was partly very stressful because I, of course, had a piano professor and composition professors, and they both treated me like I'm a full-time student, of course. So, yeah, managing it was difficult, but I also knew I wanted to play the piano, not only because I had fun doing it, but also because I needed to earn money somehow. I was earning more money as a pianist until my late 30s than as a composer, which is quite natural for our profession. So I played a lot of concerts to finance my composing. And when composing became more successful, so I played less and less concerts, but I'm still considering myself a pianist, and I need the experience of playing concerts, but I'm just not with a goal of being, you know, like the classical pianist who travels around and plays Mozart concertos. This was not never my goal. But I still play with orchestra, I still play concerts, and it's a lot of fun. But I'm doing it much more relaxed now, not in a competition with others or something. It's just something that I learned to do and that I enjoy doing, and that I also enjoy doing for my composition, because, as you know, as a performer, you realize certain things about the music you perform only when you perform it yourself. You know exactly when the audience is drifting away, when, you know, when it's exciting. So, and also performing my own music in front of my audience, I think, has probably improved my criticism of my own work, because I realize what is good, what is bad, you know. And I always take that experience with me for new pieces.
And you also think, because you're performing yourself, that you can feel us more, that you know what is maybe challenging,
yes, of course,
for someone who's playing your music.
I mean, as you know, I actually also worked as an opera singer once, just to learn how that is. You know, it was an experimental opera by a colleague, and it didn't involve great singing like you do, but more like noises, like something like that. But I had to stand on a stage and learn by memory, and had to see the conductor on various screens. And only then I realized how really, really hard that is, and much harder than composers usually think. Because they think, yeah, why is the singer not in rhythm? And if you just switch between different monitors, and they also have a time lag because of the digital technology, then you realize how difficult it is really to do that.
So what do you appreciate in performers and interpreters?
Oh, I love performers who give everything. I mean, we as composers, we need them. Performers who really take their profession seriously, who really want to make the pieces shine, I mean, whatever they are, even if they perhaps don't like them that much. I think that is the utmost professionalism, I guess, yeah, that you perform a piece that you perhaps are a bit critical of, but you give everything for the piece, and I think that's great. That was also always my attitude as a pianist. I was also performing pieces of other composers, of course, yeah, but I always try to make the best of it, even if I, you know, didn't understand the music or something. And sometimes through performing it, I understood the music better, of course. And that's also a good process, I think, that you learn by doing. Yeah,
I like that too, that sometimes I'm a little, I don't actually like this piece, and then you get into it and suddenly you might like it.
Yeah.
Or as you say, even if you don't, if it stays like this, then okay, you have to do something with it. That's the job of an interpreter. And it's always very fascinating, but you feel so many things already when you get this piece, what this person is like. And I also like it, I mean, we also have been working for quite a while, that when I get to work with a composer again and again, I get to dig deeper, and I get a deeper understanding, even though maybe the first pieces I'm like, okay, I don't really know. And then suddenly, like, this is how it goes. This is how he thinks. Because through your composition, I don't know, somehow you let me get into your whatever, your thinking, your feeling and everything. And it's very generous and maybe also vulnerable, because interpreters can read so much out of it.
Yeah, and they also, of course, add to the pieces, no? They add elements that the composer hasn't intended. And that, for me, is the most beautiful thing, actually. Yeah, if something happens that I didn't really think about that much when composing, and suddenly a performer brings that aspect of the piece out and changes it, and it becomes a co-composer, in my opinion. So I always try to teach my students to be really thoughtful of the you know, the musicians that play their music. Not only the listeners or the critics or the audience, you know, the musicians are really, really important. And one of the reasons why, for example, Gustav Mahler, the composer, has been revived as a composer, one of the main reasons for it is that the performers really like playing his music. So I don't know a single orchestra musician who doesn't enjoy playing a Mahler symphony, because he composed in a way that takes every musician seriously. So every contribution by the horn player, by the oboist, they are all important to the piece. They all have beautiful moments in the piece where they can shine. And this is brilliant with Mahler. Yeah? Also, the conductors like his pieces because he was a very good conductor, and they can tell that he also wrote for good conductors. Yeah? So that is very, very important. Not only the listeners, but also the people playing the music and then making it great. You know, this is really important that you think of them.
Wow. That's already a very ideal situation if you have all the musicians who really love it and
Yeah, because if you don't, then people won't play, well, your music won't survive, your music won't find interest. I mean, Schubert is another case in point, you know. I mean, he had lots of, he was writing for his friends, as we know, for his singers that he knew, friends that he knew. And people really liked playing his music, yeah. It's sometimes very tricky, Schubert, as we know, yeah. But they enjoyed it. They enjoyed it because something is fascinating about it, yeah. So, and that is the main reason why they were the Schubertiades. And then, of course, the growing appreciation of him as a composer, which he didn't experience in his lifetime, as we know.
I mean, for me, it's also always interesting with pieces to discover myself in a new way or to grow. And as you said, if I really also have fun with it, that's really the best, that I'm not just whatever fulfilling a job somehow, but I'm really like, oh, this is so cool and I like what I can do with it. And I wish for such pieces. You mentioned that you're teaching composition. And you already told us a little bit what you're maybe teaching, but I also would like to know what, or is there anything you learned from your students?
Yeah, constantly. I think that's the most important aspect, that it's a mutual learning process from both sides. Of course, what I try to do for them is coaching them, is trying to find out where their talents are and what they try to do, and I give them feedback about how much they succeed doing it. Yeah. And that might help them to become, to realize themselves more and to express what they are in a better way. But on the other hand, of course, I learn from them. I learn what is the aesthetic question of our time, for example. What is different from the aesthetic questions that we had in when I was studying? Where does music go? What new ideas are around? What is fascinating to them? What doesn't interest them? What are their problems? What are their successes? You know, and from that analysis, I keep up with the music of our time much more than if I was just composing lonely in my study and you know, doing my stuff. They challenge me, you know, and I think that challenge is great. So I love when students ask critical questions in my seminar, and that's something that, okay, this is okay. They challenge me about that, and do I have an answer? And perhaps I don't, yeah, and perhaps they have the answer, and that's absolutely okay.
Cool. And when I go back to your composition style or some of it, I mean, you have a different way of expressing yourself, but there are pieces like parts of your Hammerklavier, which is one of a very known cycle by you for piano. I think there's one where you're also like running around and where you really you go to the limits. Also in a very physical sense. And I've sang this piece by you, Bring It Up and Bring It Down. And that's a piece, I mean, it was good that most of, I think all the time we did it, it was the last piece in the program. Because that's also interesting because when you practice something or at home or with then in the rehearsal, it's never the same like it is in the real performance setting. And whenever I did it then on stage with an audience, this whatever 10-minute piece felt like I'm running a marathon. And afterwards I thought I'm like falling over. I never had that in rehearsals, but it's such a physical experience. In a way it's fun, but it's weird like whoa. And I know some pieces of yours have this quality. Some are also very lyrical, like the sing with Sing It Lies or things like that. And I also know that you're kind of into sports, and sometimes you also do things in a very intense or maybe even extreme way. So is this what is maybe the parallel thing between that some pieces really go to the limit, or is this a quality of yours?
I don't know if it's a quality. I mean, I'm sure I have some kind of obsessive personality. Hopefully not in a bad way, but in a positive way, because I get obsessed about things and then really try to deep dive into them. Yeah. And so for me, also performing, I found that I had a lot of stage fright when I was starting out as a pianist. I was really, really scared to perform. Sometimes I couldn't sleep 2 weeks before a concert or something. It was really bad.
If I had seen you on stage, I never would think that.
Yeah, but I overcame it through various harsh methods. But I mean, the main method being that I just played a lot of concerts. So I constantly was in that situation. But also I found that the more demanding the pieces were that I played, the more I could forget the situation of the concert. And one of the most played hammerclavier pieces, One Man Band, actually came out of that wish to do something so outrageous on stage that I would forget that I'm actually playing in front of people. I would have to concentrate so hard on putting my foot on the keys and stuff like that, you know, that I would forget about my stage fright. And that actually helped me overcome that. And I also think of it as a spiritual thing. You know, there was a big spiritual movement in contemporary music in the 70s. Let's talk about composers like Terry Riley or something, you know. It's where music comes close to meditation and, you know, yeah. And I thought about, are there other ways of going into this trance-like state that where you transcend reality in a way, yeah, without having minimal patterns all the time, you know? And are there other ways of to do that? And that was a bit of the reason why pieces like Bring Me Up, Bring Me Down, of which you are the definite interpreter. I mean, definitely, I mean, you did this brilliantly, this piece. Having pieces that have these extreme demands on the performers, and I would always play them myself as well. And there were some pieces that I actually wrote where I thought, okay, nobody will be as crazy as me as playing these pieces. And then I suddenly realized that others were playing them and much better than me, you know. For example, the Jerusalem piece that you talked about, where you run about the piano, I did this alone for, I think, 10 years. And then great pianist Riccardo Descalzo came around and did for me like the definite interpretation of this piece. Nobody does it like him, because he just completely obsessively tried to realize every detail of this piece in a perfect way, brilliantly. Yeah? So I'm very happy about that. Right now, to give you a very sneak peek into my work, right now I'm actually preparing the premiere of a 12-hour piano piece that I'm working on, which I probably need another 12 years to finish. But the first hour is finished, and I will do that in the Gaudeamus Festival this year. And I'm very scared of that already. Yeah. But this will be a piece where I plan to play at some point 12 hours without break. Yeah. I mean, there might be toilet breaks, of course. Yeah. But
wow, cool. So you play it yourself, yeah?
I will play it myself, which is also a really stupid idea, because I have less and less time to practice, but I will somehow try.
That's really amazing. Wow. Yeah, it explains me also some, because as you said, with Bring Me Up, Bring Me Down, you're so busy with doing it. I think I really didn't think about the audience or anything.
Exactly. And this is becomes a moment of truth. For me, this is really a philosophical thing.
Yes.
We all know the term authenticity, and we adore musicians who have this kind of authenticity. We can tell with Maria Callas, for example. I mean, that is something extremely authentic, how she sang. It was not a show, you know, it was her in that moment, and that makes her art so great. And having these kind of over-the-top performances, I think, brings out this quality in all musicians, I think. This authenticity is something that we all have as musicians, and we can find it in kind of overcoming difficulties, also obstacles, also risking to fail, which I think is an important element. Yeah? We have always this strange image of perfection, you know, every sung note must be perfect and every played note on the piano should be perfect. And that is very, very inhumane, I think. It's not what we are. Of course there's imperfection, and of course there must be risk, there must be something that can sometimes work, sometimes not. Otherwise, it's not really interesting to look at and to listen at. Yeah. So, yeah, this is also another element, to find an aspect of virtuosity. Because in typical contemporary music, which very often is very abstract and more method-driven or, you know, conceptual, it's sometimes very difficult for the listeners to understand what the obstacles actually are. The composer for sure had some obstacles, and the performers have obstacles. But very often it's hard to tell, did they fail or not, you know? I mean, there were a lot of notes. Some might have been wrong, some might have been correct. We don't really know. And that removes for me an element of that. And there are composers like Ferneyhough who try to go so much over the top that they probably also seek some kind of authenticity. This is another way to do it. It's not my personal way, but I can understand why they do it.
Yeah, I start to understand a lot. That's great how I think many composers search for this truth, and as you said, they use different ways to hopefully achieve it. And yeah, so yeah, it's very interesting. And you're also, I mean, we mentioned the playing the piano, we mentioned the composing. Those are big parts of your life. But you also blogging, you're writing, you have been conducting, and all that, you're teaching, you're into sports, you have many interesting hobbies as well and collecting things. So how did this all show up, or how do you handle all of this, or is it also the thing this everything you do inspires the other?
Yeah, I think it comes naturally because I'm just a very curious person and I don't judge the things that I may become curious about. So some people prefer to set very clear borders of about what interests them and what not. And what doesn't interest them, they just ignore. But I can imagine being interested in something that I'm not interested in at the moment. And it could perhaps become very obsessive as well, you know? I remember I visited a friend once and she's very much into watches, into clockwork. And she has a store where she sells watches. And I'm not at all interested in watches. But she led me through the store and she showed me all the different watches and told me all these stories. And I could absolutely understand her personal obsession about it. And if she had talked a bit longer, I might have started collecting watches as well. So everything like that can draw me in and can fascinate me. And as you say, I tend to have too many hobbies, too many interests, and it becomes very chaotic sometimes. And I don't really know how to handle it also sometimes. I have no perfect way about it, but I just know that this curiosity is a very strong drive. And so I begin every day with, you know, the hope that I will learn something new and experience something new. And that gives me energy also for the other things. So it's a mutual process.
Yeah, I'm very led by curiosity. But for me, you're also such a great example, and also I've talked about this in some podcast episodes, that you're successful and you're like multifaceted, because and I also have these different talents, and in younger ages, or sometimes I also got told, well, you have to focus on one thing to be really good. And I never could, because somehow it was not in my personality, but I felt wrong for a long time. I'm like, oh, I'm not getting so successful because I'm not focusing on one thing. And so I'm always glad when I see other people, they also just live all the facets, and they're happy and even successful. And because, as we mentioned before, I mean, I have to be authentic. And so, I mean, for some people, it really works. They're whoop, just in one direction. But I'm obviously not that kind of person.
It's great that you are not that kind of person because I think all musicians can profit from having interests outside of music. It will actually enrich what they do with music. We know that Messiaen was an ornithologist and collected bird songs from all over the world. He actually spent months of time where he wasn't composing, but just traveling with his wife, who was a pianist, as we know, and just recording bird songs in somewhere in Guatemala or something, you know. I'm sure there was no piano close by, but it was important for him. Gieseking, the pianist, he was interested in butterflies. Dvorak was a train fanatic. He was, you know, having model trains and, you know, constantly checking where the train systems in the world, how they worked and stuff like that. And I think all of this enriched their music and it made them better composers, I'm sure, better musicians. And we all know these, what we call in German, Fachidioten, you know, like people who just do one thing and they are really good at that one thing, but because they don't have anything else to say, it's very difficult that they actually bring joy to other people with that one thing that they do, because it's so exclusive and so focused. I'm not so sure if I'm that person, and you are surely not that person as well.
No, I found this talk then, and I talked about it a lot. It's by a British guy whose name I have forgotten right now. He calls it slow motion multitasking. And it's this thing, not multitasking in a thing that I whatever use the phone and do this, blah, 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 blah. But more like you have whatever different projects and you switch in between. And there was even a research, I don't know, it's actually from 60s or 70s, where they looked at famous scientists, also like Albert Einstein and so on. And they figured out that all those great people, they always worked on different projects. Albert wrote different papers. And then they got successful. And for one, he got the Nobel Prize. But it was not that he was just working on one. And sometimes things are also fascinating, like with Charles Darwin. His main interests were earthworms. But he got famous for whatever, writing about a baby and doing this his theory thing, the surviving of the strongest. But that was his thing. And finally, in the end, he got to write this book, but nobody cares about this book.
I think the earthworm specialists do care a lot about this book. Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, constantly judging what will make you famous, what will be important, is actually hurtful, I think, because we very often are not in control of what makes us successful or what will happen with these things. As you say, the relativity theory might have been one of many, many things that Einstein worked on, and perhaps he was surprised himself that it became so important. And sometimes if I look back at my own career, I'm surprised about what pieces turned out to be really important and what other pieces that I thought would be really important and where I put a lot of work in turned out to be not that important. And it's a bit out of my control. So I have to think of myself. I have to think of the experience that I have. And that is also one of the reasons why I write this 12-hour piece, because I realized that we have, especially in Corona times, which were very difficult for all of us as musicians, as you know, I realized that there's also a reason to play music just for yourself, just to experience playing the music. It's not necessarily important that an audience is there and listens to it. You know, you can play a Schubert sonata, and the Schubert sonata is there, the composition is in the room, and you experience it, and it's doesn't matter if somebody else is there, you know. It's you are also conversing with Schubert at that moment, yeah. And of course, it's beautiful if an audience can partake of it, because it's a ritual. Concerts are rituals where we mutually discover music, where we mutually celebrate this crazy art form. But it's absolutely also relevant if you do a concert in front of two or three people. It doesn't matter. You know, it's as important also in the experience of our lives. It might touch something in these few people's lives that turns out to be more important than if you had played the concert in front of 100,000 people. We all know how influential the Verein für private musikalische Privataufführung by Schönberg was, where, you know, when Pierrot Le Nair was first performed and so, and how influential that was for the music of the whole planet. And it was performed probably in front of 10, 20 people. And it turned out to be really important. Yeah. So you never know. Yeah. You might give a concert tomorrow and some kid is in the concert, and this kid turns out to become a brilliant scientist or musician inspired through your concert. You don't know. Yeah, it can happen. This could be the most important experience for some person in that audience. So
yeah. And that's, I think that's the hardest thing to do, to let go or trust or not to maybe try to find the formula.
Yeah.
How can I get famous or whatever if I want to be that? Yeah. And for me, it's, I also realize as older I get, it's more about being fulfilled and enjoying. And it's a nice side effect that somehow I also am successful.
Yeah, of course, fame is not bad totally, because it gives you some freedom to realize projects that perhaps otherwise you wouldn't be able to realize. Yeah, but doing everything just to be the most famous at that particular moment, I think, is a bad strategy. And it also breaks a lot of people, I think, especially when the fame comes in the wrong moment. I've seen so many careers of colleagues actually, you know, self-destruct, even though they were at a certain point extremely successful, but it didn't turn out to be good for them. So I always tell my students, I mean, I wish you luck to be successful, but I also wish you luck to be not successful in the right moment, because that might actually make you greater, make you a greater artist, and in the end turn out to be make you more successful in the end.
Oh.
Yeah. And if you look at the careers of the great musicians, I mean, we all know Rubinstein never won the first prize in any competition. He won lots of second and third prizes and didn't do a lot of competitions at all anyway, but he still had a great career. And there were great devastations and you know, horrible things happening to Mozart and Beethoven, you know, real failures in their life, artistic failures where they really felt everything is going downhill, where people were criticizing them and so. But it made them better. It made them better because they persevered and because they were great artists, and that shone through even through the turmoil that they had.
And so how do you get all those things done? You're lots of talents and
I don't know.
And
I try to be, I mean, I learned from my mother. She comes from a very Prussian upbringing, although she's not at all, you know, and she doesn't dislike enjoying herself or something, which sometimes is also associated with Prussian, as you know, morale. But she's very efficient, and that's what I learned from her. And, you know, not mucking around, you know, not constantly contemplating what you would want to do, but just do it immediately. And I think that helps to just not think about what you might do, but do everything immediately. So if I'm interested in something, I'd go there and look it up and don't procrastinate it. And if I need to practice, then I do it. And I don't, you know, first make a tea or talk to my friends before I start practicing, but I just start doing it. And I think that that's one of the things that helps me.
And do you have, like, do you write it down like a to-do list, or are you, do you know
sometimes,
it's just
sometimes
what has to happen this day, and it's this inner feeling, okay, this has to be done?
Yeah, sometimes when it gets very dense, I make detailed time schedules, but I also always have some systems going on to get things done. For example, I know if I have to do something that I actually don't like, I put aside half an hour every day to do it, so it's not too long, but I force myself to do it until it's finished. And so every day I have certain tasks that I do, like practicing that and that much, working on compositions that and that much. I also have my schedule for my training by my coach, so I know I have to do this today and this tomorrow, so, and that helps me to get things done. But I also try to of course plan free time when I can just sit down, read a book, play a game, you know, meet with friends. That's equally important. Yeah, we all know that sometimes a short trip in the middle of a really hectic schedule, a day trip or, you know, just a walk in the forest or something, can help you to actually get things done, because otherwise you just despair and get overwhelmed.
Yeah, I learned that also more and more, even though it seems so paradox at first, because you think,
yeah,
oh my God, I'm giving away a whole day or something, but
yeah,
usually it changes something and you get
absolutely
faster in a different way or clearer.
Yeah.
And yeah.
But I say this like everything is always, you know, wonderful, but it isn't, of course. I'm stressed very often. Sometimes things overwhelm me as well. And it's not always easy. For sure. But on the other hand, that it's not easy is also part of life, because otherwise it would be really boring if everything worked like a clockwork, you know, everything would be super efficient. I would always get my work done. That would be kind of boring also. And boredom is also the enemy of good art.
And do you have a certain practice for the composing, or can you do it anytime?
I very much like to start composing first thing in the morning. If I work on really important pieces, that's, I think, before I even enter the internet in any form, I think the best thing is to compose for 3 hours in the morning. I get a lot of stuff done. If I have 3 hours in the morning where I can compose, I can actually proceed quite quickly. But that needs to be totally before I my mind becomes lost in other things. I think that's the best moment. For me, it's more difficult to do it in the evening. So usually in the evening, what I will do is like doing layout work, correcting things and stuff like that.
And we touched already many things, but is there anything you would like to add to the question? What does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in this music business, and how do you keep true to yourself?
Yeah, I think one of the dangers I talked about already is that a lot of people put expectations in you from a certain point on. This might be perhaps your agents or your record company, or even people that mean well with you, you know, your friends, and that say, oh, you should do that, more of that, you should do more of that. And I'm not saying that you should rebel against everything that other people say to you, because very often they might be right. And it's good advice, of course. But you always have to ask yourself, am I still truthful to what I really wanted to do as a musician and what I want to achieve? And for me, one of the main reasons why I'm doing this job, or whatever you call it, it's probably not a job, but some weird thing, is freedom. And the feeling for me of utmost joy when I have a commission and you know, and I can write a piece, and actually I can do what I want. I can do the most crazy things. I can have the people run around the piano or sit under the piano or jump over the piano, and I can just do it. And for me, that feeling of freedom, and also inspiring other people to find freedom in some form, which I think art always does. Art always creates this counter world that inspires people to survive sometimes even, you know. I mean, we know that people survived in concentration camps by playing music, literally. And it's such a wonderful thing to be able to do that. And once you lose that freedom, because people want to put you somewhere to you know, to exploit you, very often that happens, yeah. Or you start exploiting yourself, which is also dangerous. You follow a dream and you try to sacrifice everything for this dream. And once you fulfill that dream, you realize that you actually lie to yourself and you achieved something that makes you very, very, very unhappy. And that is, for me, a very, very strong philosophy. So that if I had the choice to do something to gain easy fame immediately by doing something that everybody expects from me, then I would probably, my insides would rebel, and I would do something that will disappoint a lot of people, but will be what I really want to do at that moment. And I don't care if it's bad for me or good for me. And with this strategy, I had lots of moments in my life where people were despairing about what I did and said, how can you do this? And we all expected you to do this. And I said, no, but my freedom is more valuable instead of fulfilling what you want that I should do. Of course, I might have also erred and failed, but having that freedom is more important to me than exploiting myself in a way that destroys me. And that is what I try to also tell my students, because of course they are in the same situation. And I remember how it was for me as a student. Of course, you are very insecure. You want success somehow to survive, you know, and the lure of following other people's commands about what you should do with your life is very strong, and you have to resist it. You have to resist it. You have to keep your independence in a way. And I absolutely adore all artists who did that. These are my heroes. Erik Satie is my hero, you know, and he never sold out to anything, you know, he did what he wanted to do. And that is for me absolutely heroic. My idols are like this, all of them. And the ones who sell out, who just do, you know, what everybody expects on them, I find much less interesting, much less interesting.
Yeah, I guess I'm also a freedom person. And sometimes I thought also maybe I didn't progress at some parts of my career as fast as I wanted or could, but it was always more important. And I think I'm a very happy art.
Exactly.
I can play, and I can also choose with whom I do music, because we also know there are some whatever toxic people around, and I don't have to work with them.
Yeah.
I recognize them better, and I stay away. And I also admire people who do their thing. And one person for me who did it in a great way, also, she's not in new music. She never was in new music. Mm. But what I really liked about her career is the singer Edita Grubarova.
Mm.
She was Slavic,
I love her.
and
Yeah, no,
she got
she's
very,
fascinating.
very early. I think it was even maybe her first engagement or second or so. She was already at the States Opera in Vienna. But for some reason, they never gave her the parts she became famous for later. And they also asked her for Deutsches Fach and all kind of those things. And she also had very early a recording deal with Deutsche Grammophon and I think even the other one, which maybe is now Sony or something. And there was then this point, and I found this so brave, even though she already was in this realm where you would think, oh my God, I wish I would have that. And she's like, they're not seeing me. And so she quit. She quit all those contracts. She then started her own label, Nightingale label. Then she only did live recordings because she could not pay the orchestra in the studio. And then she did her bel canto thing, which she really was splendid at, and she got really who she was. But this takes so much courage to get away from the biggest recording companies to say, no, this is not me. And I admire her so much for this. And I also admire her when she was about 60 years old and she was still singing. And I even know who she went to. She went to a vocal teacher, even so, she was an amazing soprano. She changed her technique, and some of the things she did then were the greatest she did because suddenly people said, oh, she can even act. Before they always thought, oh, she's not a good actress. And I mean, the recordings she's singing when she's 70s, and they're just so cool, flawless, great technique. And I'm like, and also, famous woman like her who says with 60, I'm fine to take lessons again and to learn something. Those are the qualities I really like a lot.
And they also, I mean, they became apparent because I really adore her work, and I always thought of her as a really very, very independent, very strong, very, very good singer. And she realized herself, and that's beautiful, I think.
Yeah.
But most people,
And
you said an important word, Irene, courage. And that's something that sadly many people find very difficult to have. And I can understand that it's like that. Most people are scared about, how to get by every day. And the lower they are in the hierarchy, the more I can understand that they are scared. But courage, lacking courage of people who are actually famous and who have the possibility to be courageous, and then they are still not courageous, that I dislike. I think it's an obligation. If you have a certain kind of standing, then you also have to have the courage, because it's easier for you than for the people who are not as much in the limelight as you are. But I find that most people are very, very scared. They're constantly scared. I mean, I have colleagues who are in really high positions, and they're scared to speak out, scared to do this because somebody might think bad of them, and so. And I don't know why. Come on, I mean, you're there, you're famous, you're influential. Why don't you open your mouth? It's easy, it's not that difficult.
I think that too, but courage is a difficult thing. I think you're a very courageous person, and I admire so much what you did in different circumstances. And I think it goes back to what you told us about your stage fright. I mean, that you said, okay, I have the stage fright, and I go through it, and I perform until it's gone. And I mean, that already shows, because courage means, or the thing is, we are also afraid. It's not, we're never afraid. But the thing is, do you still do it? And that's, I think, then the difference. And you can also let your fear, whatever, oppress you. And then you're like, oh, I don't do that, da, 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 and regret it all your life. Or you're like, okay, I don't know what's going to happen.
Exactly
I don't
that
know if I
regret.
fall down, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Exactly that regret is something that I always feared more than other things. That I would at some point say, oh, I wish I had done that. And that is something that I never want to say in my whole life. I don't want to regret not having done something that I would have enjoyed doing and that would have been good for me, and I just didn't do it. No, I want to do it.
Yeah.
And if that means, like Gruborova, to learn have composition lessons when I'm 70, then that's absolutely fine. I wouldn't mind, you know. One of the most impressive people I met in my life was an 86-year-old New York lady who started with 86 learning Chinese because she was just interested in it. And she had a Chinese neighbor and she was inviting her for tea every day. And together they learned Chinese. And I think that's fantastic. I want to do that when I'm 86. I want to still discover something that I want to learn and, you know, as long as I can. And this lady actually turned out to be to have a very long and rich life. I think she nearly got to the age of 100 years or so. Yeah. But that's absolutely adorable. I love that.
That is totally adorable. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, even though I often ask, what tip do you have for young composers, or artists, we already covered so much and there were so many great tips. I mean, to be yourself, to be curious, to be open, to live your whole life. I mean, to grow. I love that myself. And I know that sometimes you also lose people because they're not growing that way. And they're like, what is she doing now?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sure you have experience, Irene. You cannot please everybody, even if you try to please everybody. Many people try to please everybody, but you will never manage. You will always fail and it will always make you unhappy. And then why give a damn, you know? it's
right.
I don't know, it's useless to lose time about worrying that somebody might not like what you just did or something. Yeah, for me, my big idol was always the opera director Hans Neuenfels, who passed away a couple of years ago. And he had many scandalous premieres where people were booing so hard, they were throwing tomatoes, they were interrupting the performance. And he, when the applause came, he would go happily on the stage. People would scream at him, full of hatred. And he would take a bow and would leave. He didn't care. and this was the person that I grew up with, basically, because I knew him when I was a small kid still. And that was something that I always adored and admired. I thought, I want to be this person. I want to be like him, because that is so courageous. He doesn't give a damn. He's doing his art. And in the end, that was what was best for him, because we all remember him now as a fantastic director who did absolutely historically great opera work, even though critics sometimes completely condemned him during his lifetime. But he didn't give a damn, and now his work is there, you know, and he did something great. So what's the fuss about, you know?
Yeah. It's a great word to end this wonderful talk with you. And I thank you so much, Moritz. It's always a delight for me to talk to you.
And likewise.
Yeah, see you soon.
All the best. Thank you for the talk.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.